Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful.
So, how's everybody doing? It's that time of the year again, Halloween time. And here I am with Henry.
Hi.
So, as I said, because we're going to do a big... It was a choice of doing the live... whatchamacallit? The live show versus... I have a big bonfire. As a matter of fact, I have a big, huge stack of wood out there. We had a tree that came down, and during the summer, it just gets too hot. So we decided we were going to do a big bonfire, and we decided today, why not? It's gonna get pretty cool. Not cold, but we've got two big stacks. So that's why we decided to do this instead of a live show to pre-record it. But anyway, the content is still the same. And this year, you know, I always try to, you know, besides we've got our stories to say and everything like that, and I don't know. Can you dig it? This is my Halloween hat. This is my authentic witch hat that I had made once upon a time when I used to dress up more for Halloween. It was, if you had a hat like this, you know, you were good. As far as you doing the rest of the witch thing, let's face it, it's a simple costume. But anyway, as a matter of fact, that's what my mom dressed me up on my first Halloween. My first Halloween, that's what she dressed me up as. But anyway, I always like to look at what's the reason why we have, because right now, like, and you've heard me complain about this in all my other shows where they've already been putting out Halloween stuff since, what was it, August, Henry?
Yeah.
Were like, you know, they, all of a sudden we walk in and they're taking off all the summer stuff, like the barbecues and the gardening stuff. And then it's all of a sudden we're like, what? And we've got Halloween stuff, right?
And then a week apart, Thanksgiving. Then a week apart, Christmas.
Right.
It's all balled up into one.
And my point being that it's become so commercialized with these different holidays as far as, you know, let's face it, we're going into the home stretch of the year, which is Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or holidays, New Year's, and then that's it. We're in the new year. That they want to hurry it along. And I remember... there was this thing like after like Labor Day is when maybe you will maybe start seeing some of the stuff for like Halloween. And it was like the anticipation was there, and it was like everything was just the Halloween. So you were a kid, it was the candy or, you know, what costume you were going to use. And, you know, and then like Thanksgiving and Christmas and everything else or all of that, everything was like way off in the future. You know, it was like all about Halloween. And all of a sudden the commercialism has taken over so much that it's like it all becomes like, what happened to the anticipation of, you know, the costume parties if when you got a little bit older or trick-or-treating? And this was, of course, me and Henry, we grew up in a time where kids would actually go out trick-or-treating and not go to the nearest mall. And by the way, I understand when you have little kids, but even then, you know, I remember growing up, yeah, of course, we always had an adult with us. My mom or somebody else was going to go, but we would go trick-or-treating around the neighborhood. That was the fun of it, just to see what you were going to get when you went trick-or-treating. Like, was it, were you gonna have good candy, or were you gonna have like, oh my god, this is horrible, like, what was it, the one that I hated was that those little corn things, what are they called, Henry?
Yeah, the the Halloween corn.
That Halloween corn stuff. It was
They're yellow and orange.
You know, there was a few candies that was like, forget it.
Yeah, and they taste horrible.
You know, it wasn't like, you know, you had to be throwing, you can throw it away. It's like, no, throw it away. I don't want that.
And they're like the candy version of Twinkies. Those things last forever.
Yeah, man. It's like, yeah. if there's an apocalypse, you'll have roaches and corn candy. Yeah.
Everything will rot except that.
Except that. So anyway, getting back to that's why I like also to look at what's behind these Halloween in this case. But this time I decided, you know what? I'm going to look at, because, you know, everybody's into Halloween, but everybody forgets that there was a big, basically, there was a reason that, you know, everybody thinks of Halloween, that the veil is the thinnest. And right after that, there was All Saints Day or All Souls Day. And if you look at it, some of it has to do with, if you want to call it ancestor worship, but there was more to it. It was like you always wanted, there was always that fear of the ghosts or of the dead coming back and haunting you for various reasons. It could be because they weren't buried correctly or they were forgotten. Even the worst, as a matter of fact, were spirits of people that had died and there was nobody there to honor them or to, you know, say prayers for them, whatever the culture was. But let's get over to that, because that's what I'm going to look at now, because believe it or not, Halloween in some cases was a question of, you know, over here in more modern times, but this thing of All Saints and All Souls Day goes back a lot. As a matter of fact, it's the All Saints, okay, which is November 1st, it's a church-wide holy day of obligation. It's also known as All Hallows Days, and this is dedicated to the saints of the church, and that is all those who have attained heaven. In other words, you went to heaven. All Souls Day, which is November 2nd, is dedicated to those who have died and not yet reached heaven. If you're Christian or Catholic especially, this is for maybe the souls that are in purgatory. Now, All Saints Day began most likely as All Martyrs Day, and this can be traced back to the earliest Christians. Again, you know, these are the martyrs, people who had died for, you know, when, you know, there was persecution of the Christians. Now, in 609, during the reign of Pope Boniface, all right, this is the time that, you know, already the Vatican is there in Rome, of course, or, you know, actual Rome. And he ruled from 608 to 615, and the Emperor Phocas, okay, gifted him a temple in Rome to the Holy See, all right? Now, a year later, Heraclius, thank God that he gave him that, because a year later, Heraclius succeeded in taking Constantinople and executed Phocas on the same day before declaring himself the emperor. So in other words, he gave the temple to the Pope, and the next year he was executed, because that's the way things were run back then. Now the temple, it's still standing today, and it's known as the Pantheon, and it was originally built in the first century. So by the time that the Pope got it, it was already like 500 or 600 years old. It was destroyed by fire, rebuilt in about 118 to 128. And during the time that the Romans had it, it was a public place to worship and honor all the Romans' gods and goddesses. All right. And it was a spectacular monument to pagan Rome. The Romans were very much the supernatural and their gods and goddesses. This was part of their normal living. All right. Even though they used to have festivities, they would look at that. You want to call it superstition or whatever. But they were very integrated into their religious beliefs. Now, chief among the Romans was a Jupiter Ammon, which was the god of sky and thunder. And there was also the worship of Janus and Vesta, which is the power of the door and the hearth. And the reason why I say this is it wasn't only that, there was a lot of there was a lot of concentration as far as protecting the home, again, from malicious spirits, the dead, bad luck, all of these things. And these were the times of years where it wasn't just like a festivity outside, where each individual homeowner went ahead and did something to like make sure things ran correctly. Now, like I said, the Janus originally stood for the magic of the door of a private house or hut, and later became a part of the state religion. The gates of his temple were formally closed when the state was at peace. And this is a custom going back to primitive war magic that required armies to march out to battle by this properly sanctified route. In other words, this belief in certain gods or in these certain customs extended. Of course, remember, your armies are basically what kept you safe, or if you were a conquering army, the success of an empire. So in other words, it was very important to do it the right way. How's that? Now, Vesta's shrine contained the eternal fire, and the cult of Vesta, which was tended by her virgins, continued to flourish until the end of antiquity and endowed an important role in the sacred protectorship of Rome. Now, these Vestal virgins were priestesses who vowed abstinence for 30 years, to focus on tending to the sacred fire at the temple of Vesta. There were 4 to 6 Vestal virgins, and they could be chosen at an early age by the chief priest, who would vow chastity for 30 years. Once their 30 years were complete, they were free to marry. However, few of them ever did, as their servitude had been to Vesta for so long. If a Vestal virgin had broken her vow, she would be severely punished. Vestal virgins were highly regarded, which made their punishment so severe. Vestal virgins typically took their designation very serious, and few ever broke the vow. And let's face it, folks. If you went in there, let's say when you were 10 years old, I'm going back, let's say they took you as a child and you served when you were 30. By the time you got out of there, you were 40. You were not going to have kids. Remember also, the lifespan back then was very shorter, much shorter than it is now. But even then, if you were going to leave and not serve Vesta, you were going to go do what? You know? Now, the unwholesome specters of the restless dead were something that were called the lemurs or the larvae. And this, I had to laugh when I read this. They were appropriated with offerings of beans. On those days, the Vestas would prepare sacred, so it was called mola salsa, a salted flour cake from the first ears of wheat of the season. And what's really interesting is that, you know, again, we come back to, and last year I said it, you know, whether it's this Halloween, All Saints Day, whatever, whatever was done, everything revolved around like a cycle of fertility, protection, good fortune, and the belief that if you didn't do things the right way, either the dead would get you or bad luck or somebody was going to stomp on you. Now, the Vestal Virgins, they prepared this mola salsa, which was what they called salted flour. And this was sprinkled on the altar, on the animal victims prior to the sacrifice, and in the sacred fire throughout the year. And the second ritual, which was performed, by the way, this was done in May. Originally, this Roman ritual was done in May. May 13th was to throw images of 30 old men into the Tiber River from the Pons Sublicus. Publicly, there were games held in the Circus Maximus in honor of Mars on the 11th and on the 13th in commemoration of dedication of the Temple of Mercury. The merchants offered up incense and used laurel branches to sprinkle water from the well of Mercury at the Porta Capena over themselves and their goods in order to obtain Mercury's aid in making their businesses prosper. Now, Pope Boniface, remember, he accepts the temple, okay. He removed all the pagan embellishments, all the statues were relocated, and he buried the remains of hundreds of Christian martyrs beneath the Pantheon. And he consecrated the Pantheon as a Christian church to the Blessed Mother and all the holy martyrs. Now, he consecrated it, coincidentally, on May 13th, which was the original date that all these activities were originally done in Rome. And that became the annual feast of all martyrs for the next 125 years. Okay, now there's some that maintain the belief that the origins, of course, were in the pagan feast of the Lemures, in which these are the malevolent and restless spirits of the dead were appropriated. And they based that idea that the Lemuria festival, first of all, that they had the identical dates, and then they were similar with having to do with the theme of all the dead. All right. Now, this thing that they called the Lemuria, all right, this, what's called the Lemuralia or Lemuria, was an annual event in the religion of ancient Rome where they would perform rites to exorcise any malevolent and fearful ghosts of the restless dead from their homes. These unwholesome specters, the lemures or larvae, were appropriated with chants and offerings of black beans, like I said before. It was celebrated at night and in silence, and during these three alternate days, that is the 9th, the 11th, and the 13th of May. During this season, the temples of the gods were closed, and it was thought unlucky for women to marry at this time and during the whole month of May, and those who ventured to marry were believed to die soon after. Quote, they marry badly who marry in May. In other words, it was even a saying, so I guess nobody got married in May. Now, the lemures were made harmful and spiteful to the living because of kinless and neglected, because they were kinless or neglected in death and after it, having no rites or memorial, free to leave their dead body, but unable to enter the underworld or afterlife. A less common but more mischievous and dangerous type of ghost known as the larvae was thought to wander about the house with the lemures. The Romans believed that there could be no knots present during the ceremony. It's theorized that knots were forbidden to allow natural forces to flow properly. Can we say the word feng shui, even though it's a different culture altogether? Yes, because there are, you know, talk about knots and allowing natural forces. Now, this ceremony that they did, all right, this, the householder, or I guess the head of the household, I guess, he's, and I'm thinking to myself, they're doing this at night. He, perhaps with the others, he walks barefoot through the house at midnight, washes his hands in spring water, takes his thumb between the fingers of his hand. This gesture is called the mano fica, or literally fig hand, to ward off any ghosts. Then takes a mouthful of black beans and spits them out behind him or throws them behind him over his shoulder for the hungry lemures to gather unseen. He chants, quote, I send these, with these beans I redeem me and mine, 9 times. And then the rest of the household clashes bronze pots while repeating, ghost of my fathers and ancestors, begone. The householder washes his hands in spring water 3 times. When he turns to see the results of the offering or exorcism, no lemures are to be seen. Larvae, on the other hand, were thought to have been entirely unforgiving, even demonic. Some of the literature presents them as persecuting the living and torturing bad souls in Hades. Now, these 3 days of Lemuralia, all right, it was thought that originally they would substitute, formerly, that they used to have human sacrifices. Now, which again, they say drives that belief that the whole month of May was unlucky for marriages. Now, all these ghost stories indicate that in ancient Mesopotamia, Greece, Rome, people believed in multiple forms of life after death. And a consistent theme throughout these accounts is the lack of a proper burial for the deceased. Indeed, burial rites were incredibly important for ancient religions. It could be said by extension that hauntings and ghosts were considered a punishment for those not adhering to it. All right. And the reason I bring this up is that in modern times, like now, November 1st, Day of the Dead, Sugar Skulls, Dia de los Muertos, if you look at that, which mostly is seen as a Mexican here, like in the United States, which is where, which by the way, though, they do it all across the world. They have different names for it. Is what is it? You go to the cemetery and you're supposed to clean up the grave. Some of them, in some cases, even put up altars, you know, with pictures and foods. All of this, if you look at it, is a way they could say, well, it's in remembrance of this dead person, but it also goes back to where you wanted to keep the dead happy because you did not want them to come and haunt you. And of course, the worst ones were the ones that had no family. Like if somebody died, and which if you look at it, you remember you've heard of if people committed suicide, or if, you know, if you were hung, you weren't allowed to be buried in consecrated ground. This is where this belief comes from. It's like you wanted to punish the person in death, or they weren't be, that's how important burial rites were. Were you allowed to be buried in consecrated ground? You know, if you were suicide, that was like a punishment, you know, because it was considered a sin or you weren't supposed to do it. Same thing with criminals that were hung at crossroads, and sometimes they were even, which all, that drives that that belief that this is why they haunted, because they were not given a proper burial. So we're getting there. So here's Pope Gregory now. Okay, this is about 100 years after Pope Boniface, and he dedicates an oratory in St. Peter's Basilica to dedicates the basilica, and he's got all the relics of the apostles, the martyrs, the saints, and the confessors. Everybody knows that these holy relics, they meant a lot. And what he does is he transfers the date from May, because remember, it was like, you know what, this looks like we're still going on with the pagan Roman rites. So they made, this is when November 1st, at least for the church in Rome, became the Feast of All Saints, and the date of May 13th was suppressed. Okay, which might be explained by supposed connection to the pagan Feast of the Lemurs. In other words, this was, you know, like a lot of different cultures and civilizations, when you look at some of their religious customs or their cultures, basically and especially among the Christians, they would take over some of the pagan rites little by little, or the dates. So if, let's say, they conquered a certain land, they wanted to little by little ease themselves into the belief system, they would adopt and rename some of the festivals or customs. Now, offering a prayer for those who have died is ancient in origin. In the Old Testament, second book of Maccabees, which was written about 100 years BC, Judas Maccabees orders his army to pray and offer sacrifices on behalf of their fallen comrades. Tombs found in the Roman catacombs are inscribed with prayer requests for the deceased. The second century writer Tertullian wrote in an essay about a woman praying for her deceased spouse. Okay. In other words, that same thing about, and even now we have it in Catholics where you have where you could give somebody's name for when the mass is like a remembrance of the dead. In other words, if you say a mass or prayers for the dead, if they're restless, if they're trapped, if they haven't gone to heaven, this is going to help them get there. Okay. Now, the faithful departed, or All Souls Day, evolved in the church calendar long after All Saints Day. And this is about 1000. By this time, it's November 1st, November 2nd. And in some of these Benedictine monasteries, like in France, they encourage the monks to pray for the souls of those who had died. And this was when they started the day after All Saints Day. And this was done for the ones, like I said, in purgatory. It was like November 1st, you're in heaven, you're a martyr. November 2nd, you're in purgatory or something's happening and you need prayers. On All Souls Day, the church prays for those in purgatory. Okay. And, you know, of course, the entire month of November, people remember the departed ones. They go to the cemetery and they give alms, do good works, ask for masses to be said. Then, of course, you have the people that they light the candles. You know, you see they display pictures of their deceased ones. Church bells are rung to remind everyone to pray for the poor souls in purgatory. Because remember, among Catholics, there is an in-between place, which is purgatory. You're not in heaven, but you haven't gone down to hell. And there's, in other words, there's still a chance for redemption. And the priests are authorized to say three masses on November 2nd. Now, in Portugal, this is what I'm saying, Portugal, Spain, Mexico, they have ceremonies for this. In Portuguese, in the Portugal, they have something that they call ofrendas, in Spanish, ofrendas. They in Spain, they play Don Juan Tenorio. In Mexico, of course, this coincides with Dia de los Inocentes, or Day of the Innocents, Day of the Dead. And Dia de los Inocentes, by the way, is when they celebrate honoring deceased children and infants. And again, in Portugal, children celebrate Papa Dios tradition, and they go from door to door where they receive cakes, nuts, all right? In Austria, Belgium, France, Hungary, Italy, Luxembourg, Malta, Portugal, Spain, in American cities such as New Orleans, people take flowers to the graves of dead relatives. And in Poland, the Czech Republic, Sweden, Finland, Slovenia, Slovakia, Lithuania, Croatia, Austria, Romania, Moldova, Hungary, and Catholic parts of Germany, the tradition is to light candles and visit the graves of deceased relatives. In the Philippines, they call this Day Undas, Todos los Santos, because remember, the Spanish were in the Philippines for 300 years, so they have a lot of Spanish influence. It's observed as All Souls Day, and again, they visit the graves of their deceased. Prayers, flowers, candles are lit, and they clean, repair, and repaint the graves. Now, the Day of the Dead, they say, is a misnomer. I'm talking about the Day of the Dead here is what we know here in the United States. Día de los Muertos. It doesn't last a day, but three. November 2nd is the main celebration, but the day before is known as Children's Days, again, or days, Día de los Angelitos, Day of the Angels. And the way they have that specific date, because it's, they said, the spirits of the children are so eager to come back to the land of the living that they run ahead of the adults who arrive a night later. Now, so here we are. Okay. And it's interesting because, as you could tell, you think here of Day of the Dead, the sugar skulls, even though, you know, you have a lot of people from Mexican origins who will say that some of the Day of the Dead celebrations have a background also with Aztec death, you know, in other words, Mesoamerican belief systems that were synchronized into the Catholic stuff. But as you could tell, maybe it was the same thing, but this goes way, way back into pagan times, into ancient civilizations, where it was always thought you had to, people believed in the dead. In other words, that once you died, they believed in the soul, and that soul or that spirit, if you didn't do the right thing, whether it was a family member or somebody else, they could come back and bring you sickness, death, ill fortune. So there was a day where you made sure that they were remembered. Because I guess for humans, there's nothing worse than being forgotten. And in some cases, you know, you have other cultures I'm sure you've heard of, especially like in the Far East, and in other cultures where they have actual ancestor worship, where they have altars sometimes with like the pictures or even the remains of, which is like way out there. But in other words, there was nothing worse for the ancestors than to have be forgotten, or that you didn't have descendants to remember you. There you go. You know, there's a lot of Oriental belief in that. Now, before, I'm going to do one really short little story. By the way, this is a short little ghost story, okay? Which, by the way, is true, but it's a little bit on the old side. But nonetheless, there's truth to it, all right? And this is right after the Civil War. It happens in Chattanooga. Now, for the first 2 years of the Civil War, there's a guy named Charles Reed. And what he does is he would drive a hack to take the dead soldiers from the battlefield in West Virginia to where they would be shipped home. Now, there were so many bodies that the practice was discontinued. All right. This is what he was doing, like right after, during the Civil War and right after. So now he tells this story and he stipulated saying, I know what a dead body looks like. So it's the fall of 1865. He's living in Atlanta, and he's returning home from the site of the battlefield that happened on July 21st, 1864. And at this time, what they've told him is he's employed to cut wood. And the sun's setting, and he sees about 200 feet in front of him a Confederate soldier in uniform mounted on a sorrel horse suddenly appears on the road. Now, the rider recedes from him and soon vanishes as suddenly as it had appeared. Now, when he reaches the area where the soldier was seen, there was no marks in the road. It was then he realizes it was a ghost. And you ask yourself, and in a way, I like these stories because some ghost stories are great because you never, there's no rhyme or reason. You never know who the ghost was, what happened to the ghost. Now, why this ghost would appear to him, because at this point, he's not transporting dead people anymore. He's a woodcutter. All right. It makes you wonder, was this Confederate soldier that he saw, did he come to him because he transported his body? You know, you never know. So there, that's a short little ghost story. And then I'm going to go to my wingman, Henry, here. He's got more modern ghost stories to talk about. What was it? Because we were talking, I said, throughout time, he's always talking to me about these different ghost stories. And then when I ask him, hey, talk about some of the ghost stories, he looks at me with this face of like, what? And he's like, no, tell me about that ghost story or that experience you had.
Which one?
What was it? Okay. Oh, that one, that lady that your mom used to know.
Oh,
that one. That's a good one.
My mom had a friend that before we met her, supposedly she was a santera. And she wanted to buy a house where everybody could actually gather. So,
but then your mom, didn't they work together or something like that?
Yeah, my mom and her worked in a textile company.
Right.
But where she lived was a little tiny apartment, so they couldn't all gather there. So she got herself a loan and bought the house.
Oh, so she got a house finally.
So
okay.
She bought the house. And she had the house for a very long time. So by the time we actually, knew her, a lot of time had passed. She was already up in years, and she told my mom that if anything happened to her to take care of the house, that her daughters would take it over. So my mom wasn't expecting that to happen. She didn't even know that she was sick. And within 6 months, she died.
Okay.
And I ended up being on deck to watch the house. It wasn't my first choice because the house was creepy.
What happened? She used to live there alone, right? I think
she lived there alone with her cat, and the cat ran away. Because when you walked into that house, even when she was alive, it was like a coldness. You could feel that, like bad juju, things were there, even though you didn't see it, and it could be 100 degrees outside, and you will feel a cold that would actually hurt your bones. And we didn't think anything of it. We said, okay, it's an old house. And we didn't think anything of it. When I had to take over the house, I said, okay, I just go turn on the heat and that's it.
I don't understand that. You said something about that the pipes freeze or something like that.
Yeah, because over there, if there's no circulation in the pipes will freeze and burst. And so will the water heater, everything will blow up. In other words, the house will flood within seconds.
Okay.
And I started getting a little bit inventive. I said, "Ooh, I could bring somebody here." So I said, "Okay, kill two birds with one stone." I helped put my mom out, and I could bring a friend. So I said, "Okay," and so I started thinking of somebody to bring. So I knew this girl, Betty. So I said, "Okay," You're gonna come with me so you can help me do the vows in the house. I said okay. So I brought a little duffel bag with blankets and stuff, and I brought it over there. So I said okay.
All
right. Hey, look, when you're a kid, when you're like 19 years old and you're broke, that is a great place to go. So
I was, okay, yeah. All right, Mr. Friendly.
So I walked through the house. I made sure there was nobody in there because my mom found squatters there.
Oh, really?
A couple of times. So they would come in through the windows and leave feces and stuff on the ground.
So what happened? They were going to sell it or what?
Yeah, they had the realtor checking out the house, but a lot of people were not jumping to move to a house that the house had needed severe repairs.
Okay.
So they had to sit in the house until they got an offer they could be good because they had to pay off all the debts and everything in the house. So I walked upstairs and I knew that I closed the door to the other rooms. And when I walked upstairs, the doors were open. The windows were open. I closed the windows. I went back downstairs and you were here. Whoosh! And I thought because those windows, those old windows, were opened up by a lead weight. It had a rope and a lead weight. The okay. weight will go down and bring the window up.
Okay.
But once you bring the window down, the weight will actually lock in place. But all of those windows in five rooms were open.
And I said, was in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, in Elizabeth, New Jersey. So I said, okay, this is kind of like messing up my very friendly mood.
So what happened? So
my friend kept on telling me, I'm leaving. I said, no. Don't leave. I will take care of it. And I went upstairs, and all of a sudden, from the attic, you hear. And I get near, and the door in the attic was open.
Oh, why? What was it? What one of those doors that I've seen a
movie? No. It was an actual walk up.
Oh, okay.
And no. The house had actual rooms. You could actually live in the attic.
Okay.
It had a 12-foot ceiling in the attic.
Okay.
Yeah, the house was not that old. The house was made in the 1950s. I never saw anybody run out that door so quickly. All I heard was, see you later.
Are you telling me she left you alone?
I'm like, pardon my French, bitch. And she goes, I'll call you later. I heard that gate in the front of the house slam. And all I saw was this 5-foot girl run down the block. And I'm left in the house. I thought, oh, damn, I'm screwed. You know, and I'm walking around and I swear I locked all the doors and everything. I got to a point I said, okay, I'm gonna have to tell my mom. She needs to go find somebody else, but this is not working. And I turned on the water heater and everything, the pipe started like heating up. But then 5 minutes later, the whole house was everything was shut off. And the house got cold again. So after like half an hour of that, I said, I'm not staying here.
So but told me something that your mom told you something that she liked Gloria, but that something was about, like she told you.
Oh yeah. My mom said that she liked Gloria, and Gloria was very nice to us. She loved my mom. She loved my mom to death. She helped my mom with everything. But she had, like bad juju, like she had, she was a santera. My mom recognized and realized that there was a lot of squatters, like in the spiritual world, that like squatters is like.
In other words, not literal squatters. Well, you say had literal squatters, but what are you saying that she had? Like entities, it's like, or what?
If they do like anything, like rituals and anything like that, Even if they get rid of the entity, resemblance of that will stay in the house. Unless you do a cleanse in that house, they will stay there. And it was like a commune in there.
So what, you think your mom then did this for her?
My mom was an opportunistic fucker. My mom did it because she didn't want to do it. She had me do it because she didn't want to do it.
No, I know that. I'm just saying that your mom did this for Gloria, because at the end of the day, she had promised Gloria to do
this. My mom was very cool like that. My mom promised Gloria that she would actually like make sure that nobody would harm the house. Mm-hmm. Because Gloria did a lot for my mom after my dad died. So my mom kind of owed her that. Right. So and her daughters lived in bunk fuck whatever. And they were not going to come. They were like very selfish. So they left my mom to do that because they know eventually, even if it's just $10,000, they will get something out of that house.
Right.
And because that they weren't going to get anything more than that because the house had over $80,000 in repairs.
So let me ask you something. What do you think was going on there then?
No, there was definitely stuff there in the house. I mean, you could go to the kitchen and you would get near the stove and it felt like the stove was on and nobody has ever cooked in that, and nobody had cooked in that house in over a year. And you could get touch the stove and the stove was warm. Walk into another room and you would smell like there was perfume or something there, and there was no furniture in the house. There was nothing there, no vanities, no nothing. And you could smell like stuff. And then I realized what my mom told me once, that if you smell flowers, there's a certain smell. And I found out later on what it is. If you smell like a certain type of flower, it's cemetery flowers. You would only see them where somebody died. Those things will only grow where somebody got killed or where somebody died.
Holy crap.
And you would smell that like pretty much all over the house. I didn't put two and two together until my mom told me, but you would smell that like clear as day.
All right.
No, no, no.
That could make, get you paranoid if you smell
something. No. I was like, damn. I have a nice
bedroom. So what happened? Did you?
No.
What did you have to keep every? What did your? I take it that your mom kept sending you back, right?
No. I threw my mom under the bus. My mom had her the Gloria's estate pay some college kid to do a little one.
But you never saw anything. It was just a bad feeling.
Well, you think about it. If you close a window and you put the little tab, and you lock the windows, and you're walking to the next room, and you hear that window go, and open up. And then you go to another room, and all the doors are closed, but then they're open. You start smelling things. And when there's no vanity, no perfume bottles, no nothing, and you're smelling things. You go to the kitchen. The stove is warm. The back door is open. You start wondering, When are you gonna start smelling pea soup somewhere?
Okay. All right. Well, now I'm gonna. Okay, I'm gonna give you the next. This is the next ghost story that I got for you guys. All right. And this is out of St. Louis. All right. This is way back when. Okay. Here's a medical student. Year is 1888. And he's dissecting a body.
Oh, sorry.
Now, when he's dissecting this body, he finds this peculiar malformation of the heart that he's dissecting. He takes the heart out, and he sees that the main arteries are entering from the left instead of the right side. So what he does is he preserves the heart in alcohol. Now, remember, folks, this was also prior to these years was when there was a lot of grave robbing, because all these universities would pay top dollar for these corpses so that they could have the medical students work on them. All right. So as a matter of fact, a lot of people that were that died in insane asylums. You know, if you were picked up in a morgue, nobody knew. You didn't have family to claim your body from the morgue, or you were one of these, you know, homeless, or you were a drunk that died on the street corner, and your body was there, and nobody came to pick up your body from the morgue. In other words, everybody even made money off the dead. They would basically this is, but even then they didn't have enough bodies, so this was there was a while that there was a big illegal, you know, grave robbing thing going on, and these universities would like, you know, pay and like bring them in through the back door. So anyway, here's a student. He takes his, you know, malformed heart, puts it in a bottle. Now, next several days after he's doing this, he gets a strange feeling that something's following him. And if he was in the dark, he would look behind him because he felt that someone was near him. But there was no one there. Now, 2 weeks later, he wakes up one night suddenly and he feels a presence in the room. And he's got some light coming in through the window. And the only place he can't see is a bookcase near the head of his bed. And this is where he kept about a dozen or more anatomical specimens. And among them is that weird heart. Now, he looks, and standing with its gaze fixed on the bottle was a shadowy figure of a man. Now, he knows it's a ghost because he can see the shape of the books and the bottles through him. And it has like a sickly phosphorescent glow. And on its back was a large guano sack, which it wore like a shawl. And the remainder of its body was naked. All right. Now, the student shouts in surprise, which attracts the attention of the ghost, turns around, comes to the bedside, and the student hears a voice say, "Do you not know me?" And the student's so scared he can't answer. I don't blame him. And the ghost says, "Wretch, you have taken away my heart, and there it is in a preserve bottle." The student is still speechless. And the ghost continues, "I cannot rest while my heart is in that bottle. I shall follow you while it remains there. I have come to demand my heart of you." Now the student sees the bottle and he's handing it to the ghost. The ghost makes to carry it away, but of course he doesn't have no substance to his body. And the jar falls to the floor and shatters. Now the heart rolls on the floor and the ghost places both hands on it. And a pale light comes from the heart, and the ghost hands were full of light, and he places them on his chest. So basically what I guess he's taken is the metaphysical form of the heart. And the ghost says, "I have my heart now. Promise me you will bury the rest of it with my body, and I will go never to return again." The student promises, the specter disappears through the open window. And of course, you know that he most definitely kept his promise. All right. And which again goes back to, as a matter of fact, I recently read an article that they were doing studies. I think it was Sweden, where they were showing a tie-in from. Yeah, and I know some of you might have heard where people that have received donated organs sometimes experience they memories or in sometimes like taste or preferences that they didn't know about. Because remember, most of the time when you receive some type of organ or a transplant, you're never told who. Sometimes I know they allow it, but there's a lot of times that you have no idea where that part came from. And there's people in this recent article that I read out of Sweden, it wasn't even organ, it was blood donations where people were having these different type of like things that they prefer to eat. And they were even looking at basically that, I guess the point is what's yours, whether it's your organs, even your blood. If you go by that study that's out of Sweden, that article's not even a month old, that there's something about what's yours. In other words, what belongs to your body that is you. And in this case, of course, this ghost can't rest because it's missing its heart. And you would think, well, it's dead. Why does it need a heart? But remember, in our awareness, there's some people that, you know, it's like, I want all of me. Like, Maybe he wasn't planning on being used for anatomical dissection. All right. And as you can see by this picture right here, this, by the way, is a real picture of an anatomy class. They kind of took these people apart. You know what I'm saying? All right. If you think about it, it was for good reason, because it was for to advance medical. But can you imagine being you and you're looking at this and you're like, what are they doing to me? Yeah, that's where that's at. So I'm going to go on. I'm going to go to my second. Okay. This is another little ghost story, and then we'll go to. Okay, this is out of Philadelphia. This is a ghost story. And there's a schooner, and it's named the George B. McFarland. And it's launched from the northeast, okay? Now, I don't know why this happened. When this schooner is about to leave, there's a medium, like as a psychic medium from Portland, Maine, claims he's received a communication from the other side announcing that the spirit of Captain Kidd would take possession of the vessel, as in the George B. McFarland. And this medium says that any ship which Captain Kidd takes over would never be lucky. And it turns out his prediction is correct. Now, first of all, the vessel from the get-go, it's never watertight since she's launched. And her first commander is a man named Captain Strong. He gives her up after two or three voyages as a hopelessly unlucky vessel. Need I say that sailors are very superstitious, but anyway. His brother, the captain's brother, takes command of the ship, and he loses money through the next three voyages. He abandons the ship in mid-ocean, the crew being landed in Europe. By the way, I looked this up, and this is accurate. This is not made up. I found the article where they came across this ship. Now, she's found in the middle of, he abandons her mid-ocean, and she's towed to a European port after being adrift at sea. She's refitted, and she's taken over by a new master. Okay, 2 days after she sailed, the new captain suffered a broken leg after being knocked down during a squall. Now, the sailors on board the McFarland said that the ghostly carpenters haunted the vessel and were always at work. They would hear sounds of sawing, planking, and always at night in the hold. And this is as if they were trying to cut the keel asunder and sink the ship. I'd be, you know, if that's the way your superstition is going to go, it's like all these ghosts are trying to sink the ship and with me on it. Now, on many occasions, it was said the crew would rush out of the forecastle shouting that hands had thrust them out of their bunks. And on more than one occasion, the entire crew jumped overboard and swam ashore while the ship was in port to escape from the evil spirits. There was always great difficulty in securing a crew for the vessel, as those who served a single voyage never returned. Now, in June of 1889, the schooner, she's once more, I don't know if this was the last one, she's abandoned at sea, and another ship, all right, comes across her, and they report that her boats had been launched and the pulleys and tackle for the lifeboats were still in the water. Her hold was full of water, and this other ship that found her was named the Orinoco. They set the wreck on fire in order to remove the possibility of a collision. In other words, where it sank, the pulleys and the tackles, I guess it was the water was not that deep and it was still above water. So basically, that's how they get rid of the ship. And of course, because they did it so that nobody else would like ride into her and cause damage. But apparently, whether there really was something going on, or was it just the power of superstition that made them believe that this was unlucky? Who knows? Who knows? So, let's get back to Henry. What's going on, Henry? What was that other story that you told me about?
The house?
That was the... God, what was it? The one that... When you were going, what was it, the DJ, when you were young, the one that the weird house.
Yeah. There was a Victorian house in Old Elizabeth, Well, people that new people now that are living in Elizabeth don't know crap. There was a part of Elizabeth they called the Old Elizabeth, that they had a lot of we'll probably consider now like a mansion, but mm-hmm. it was like an old Victorian house with four floors. That house looked like at one time it was beautiful. We were looking for before I became like a famous DJ. I was like 19, 20 years old, so everybody there had a hustle. We had to like find, either do house parties, do birthday parties, or stupid weddings. So which it was kind of like so gay. And
all right.
So if we were lucky enough to do our own venue, we would easily make up the difference of what we lost in those parties. But you will have to be able to be like super cheap, because so, the majority of those kids that would come to those parties, they didn't have a lot of money. So we had to make it feasible for them. Mm-hmm. So we would make the money in volume. So if you charge $15 a head, that was a lot of money in the '80s.
Yeah.
So you charge $15 a head and throw in some chips or soda, and you get 20 or 30 people, you make decent money. Not great money, but decent money. So everybody will look out for everybody else. If whoever was throwing the party, all our other friends will look for the house or the hall, because the hall had to hold at least close to 50 or 100 people. Because by the time you...
So in other words, you're telling me everybody always knew you guys wanted something large but cheap?
Yeah. And we will all look out for each other. Like if I was doing it, all my friends would look for a place and they will ask me if it's right for me. Because the most we will be able to probably pay is under like $600.
Right.
So, because everything cost us a lot of money. So one of them drove by and saw the Victorian house. And it had a for sale sign in the house. So we all got together and we went and checked it out, but we couldn't get in. So we went back a second. By the third day, we saw somebody going in there and opening up the gate. So we rushed him. The guy almost had a heart attack. He saw like 10 kids running to him. So, and we talked to him and we talked to him like professional. We said, look, we want to do a party. Is there any way that we could rent this place? He said, look, this place is very run down. We have electricity. The electricity is running 100% in the main hall, partially in the rest of the house. I would ask the owner
mm-hmm.
and see what they say. And if they say it's okay, you will have to stay within the hall, the main hall, and you can only use one bathroom. You can't go upstairs. You can't go to the basement. You can't go roaming around the house, because it becomes a liability.
Right.
So you're only renting one room. And you can't cook because the kitchen is unstable. And you might set fire to the house. So I said, okay. So we agreed. And we went back, set up and everything.
But what happened? The owner said, okay, I got to take it.
Yeah, the owner called us back by the next day. He said, look, can you guys do 500? It was $100 less than what we were, but within our budget.
Right.
So we said, okay. So we put all our equipment in and everything to get ready for Saturday, to do it on Saturday. So we walked around. That property was huge. The property was like 5 acres, because it was like 2.5 properties together.
Okay.
And it was all wooded because it hadn't been used. They had a caretaker's house in the back.
Okay.
So we didn't know what was in there because we didn't have time to look around. So we went in and we did our little gig, and we had friends that came, but we had to put like caution tape, because you always get that one idiot that decides to roam around. So
it's almost more than one sometimes.
Yeah, because they want to be curious, they want to be adventurous. So we were hoping to be able to do more venues there, so we wanted to make the person happy. So we did our party. The party was like a success. We got close to about 100 people there, and we made our money.
Where did you put the caution tape?
We put the caution tape in going up to the stairs.
Ah, okay.
And because upstairs, the floors were rotted. So they didn't want nobody going upstairs because they could go through the floor.
Sure.
So, and the fourth floor was completely shot. The fourth floor, you could literally loop from the third floor into the fourth floor.
Okay.
And the attic was non-existent. The attic, the whole roof was shot and everything. So it would be like a little waterfall. The water would come down. That's what the guy said. And we did really great. And then we were playing like we never played before. And we heard a scream. One stupid ass bitch went upstairs and got lost upstairs.
There was that one that forgot what that. The
yeah, yeah, that she said she saw something. She went to use the bathroom because somebody was using the bottom bath.
She had to go, right?
Yeah,
when
yeah.
You gotta go, you
and
gotta go.
They was doing not the first, but the number one. But and so she went upstairs. We didn't even know. We didn't even know. And then we heard a scream. We had stopped the music, and we went out. We went over there, and we heard her like running down the stairs, almost busting her ass on the steps, and we screamed at her. And she said that she had to use the bathroom, and that she saw somebody walking around upstairs. They looked like an older woman. And I said, "Oh shit, we got a homeless." And she goes, no. The lady was like clear. She meant transparent. And she was wearing like old clothes, like old people's clothes. You know, I guess she only had a third grade education because it was period, Alfred.
Okay, but you told me something also, that something happened to one of these guys that was with you, that when he took out his smoke, the smoke whatever thing.
We found out like later on when we came, that they buried somebody in the yard, but at that time we didn't know. We had our friend that we were taking turns DJing so that one would be a chance to rest, go to the bathroom, eat something. So it was three of us doing it. And when I was doing it, he went outside to smoke a cigarette. We were not there, since the house made out of wood, and it was a lot of brittle wood and stuff.
Right.
That was adamant about no smoking in the house, no cooking in the house. He even said, "Don't bring a freaking house hot plate. I don't care. Go to McDonald's or go to Kentucky, but you do not cook in this house." So, but he went outside. He was smoking his cigarette, and then he came in all pale and kind of, well, more pale than usual. And he said that he saw somebody coming from the woods. It was like somebody like an older man. Like same thing with older, like old period clothes. And he was walking to him like really fast. And the clothes was kind of like bloody. And when he told us that, I said, "Oh man, somebody got mugged."
Ask you something. Did he think it was a real person or not?
No, he thought it was a real person, because the thing about it is, at the time, since he was coming in between the woods,
right?
He didn't have a chance. He didn't get took a chance to investigate it. He
hauled ass.
He ran back inside and told us, and he didn't go back outside for the rest of the night. So we went. So we found out like later on when we locked up, because that's what they told us, lock up and put the key in the box.
Right.
So we called the guy, and he came back the next day, and he very, very nice guy. And he said, "You know, thank you for guys cleaning up, because that's one of the first things I told you. Thank you for cleaning up. You guys will be able to rent this again." The guy was very happy with the deal you made, and he said, "You guys can rent it anytime you want." So we asked him, you know, is all this true? We saw some stuff here. He goes, yeah, I didn't want to scare you guys, but yeah, the house is haunted.
He forgot to leave that part out.
He goes, you know, these people needed the money. You guys needed the place. So it's like, and he goes, to be honest, the owners said it was haunted. I didn't believe it either.
Oh, he didn't believe it. Okay.
You know, and we told him about our friend saw outside, and he said that, the lady's husband is buried outside. Now, this is the clincher. The house was made in the 1800s. The people were going through hard times, and the husband and wife got into a serious argument, and the lady lost it. She lost her shit, went and got a wood axe and hacked up her husband.
Okay.
And when she realized that she actually, like, that was her meal ticket, and that she wasn't going to have food or anything else, she went nuts. She started putting parts of her husband in the fridge and buried the rest in the yard.
So she really made him a meal ticket.
And so she ate her husband for quite a while and did that same thing to a couple other people. And to the lady just died of old age. So the person that was buried in the yard is her husband.
So how did they find out about this thing?
Huh?
How did they find out that she had done this stuff?
Later on, well, I mean, like, they were suspecting because people would come and check up on her because she was old. When all that happened, she was old.
Okay.
And they would not see the husband. They would not see anything.
So what did she say?
She said that her husband, died, and she buried him in the yard. And they didn't want to take that as a affirmative answer. So the lady...
What, nobody suspected she'd killed him and was eating him?
No, no. They thought that because she was losing her shit. They thought that she was just like a lady blabbing. You know, like, oh, I wish my husband would die. So,
but if the guy's not around, what did they think he went?
No, this is the thing. So they went, one of her neighbors, because by the time they actually did that, they were building houses. Originally, there was no house around there.
Right.
She was the first, that was the first house. And it was huge. It was like 5 acres. So by the time she got a neighbor, her neighbor was like the equivalent of like a Karen now.
All right.
So she started like checking up on her all the time. And the lady would tell her F off.
Okay.
So the Karen, she should have been nicer to the Karen because the Karen actually got the authorities to go check up. So when they went and they checked up and stuff,
that's funny.
They found in the back of the house a bloody axe in the thing. And she said that she killed a deer. There hadn't been deer there in 20 years.
Oh, well, there you go.
So they checked the blade of the axe, and they realized it was human blood. So then they went and dug up what supposedly was her husband, and saw that there was only the head, a foot, arm, like
it was incomplete.
Yeah, and that, like pieces, like they're buried in there. And then they found like maybe a lady and two other men. And they said she must have done that within like 5 years.
Let me tell you something. That's crazy. But you know what? You think now it's impossible, but it's not. It's not impossible.
See, when you have an area that only has two houses, and
yeah, you can
two
get away
three
with
houses,
a lot of stuff.
And they're all like spread apart. You have a like maybe 5 or 10 acres splitting the properties apart. Nobody back then really talked to anybody.
Okay, well, guess what? The next little ghost stories, these are like short little blobs. I'm going to go back to your, we're going to San Francisco now, all right? This is San Francisco, And there's a lady. Her name is Josephine Schroeder. She's a dressmaker. And she divorces her husband in 1889, which, by the way, everybody knows divorce in 1889. That was not common. And she cites that the reason why she's divorcing him is that he treated her cruelly, saying that their child was dying and he just slept. He was, quote, blissfully, entirely oblivious to the fact that a few feet away his daughter was dying. Now, she goes on to say that this is obviously previous to the divorce. This is when the daughter is sick. She says, yes, and a rap came at the door. I did not believe him when he told me that some ghostly visitant had always rapped upon the door when there was a death in his family. Now I do believe him. I heard the raps. I opened the door and nobody was there. I don't know what this rapping means. Friends and neighbors have heard it as well as myself. Mr. Schroeder is not a spiritualist. We have never had a teacher of that doctrine in our home in Fulton Street, but it is all ended now. Remember, 1889, spiritualism was in its heyday. And that's why she's pointing out that they're not spiritualist or have that belief system. A neighbor named Mrs. O'Keefe was present when the child passed away. She also heard the raps and thought that this was that the death summons had come. And you know, there's the Irish believe like in the banshees and things like that, which are like portenders of death or something like that. Now, the husband, his name is Richard Schroeder. He then says, I don't believe in spiritualists at all, but I do know this. Before my brother's death and before my sister's death, a rapping came at the door. I don't pretend to explain it. I only know it is so. Neighbors have heard it. I cannot doubt the evidence of my own senses. My father was a contractor. He was run over by a lumber wagon in 1865. Shortly before his death, there came that tap, tap, tap at the door. My mother hurried to see who had called, but there was not a soul in the hallway. In 1866, my sister died in Chicago. On the night of her death, there was a rapping on the door. At my brother's death, there was the same mysterious rapping. I can't account for it. My folks were Presbyterians. I'm a Protestant. I don't believe in haunted houses. Neither do I believe any of the boys were trying to fool me. He's like saying, thinking somebody was pulling a joke on him. Schroeder had worked for 7 years at the Fulton Ironworks and was reputed as sober and reliable. Now, again, like in some Irish, these banshees, they belong to a certain family. In other words, families would have these personal, basically, warning of when somebody was going to die. And apparently he did. Even though his last name was Schroeder, and which I think it was a German name. But there you go. All right. Now, next one, we're going to go into your neck of the woods, Henry. This is New York. Ooh. Okay. Now, it's the 19th century, the 1800s. And there's a hospital that was established on 14th Street in New York. It was called the Société Française de Bienfaisance. And it was established only to treat the French community. Because, of course, remember, this is the times where communities, people move into from their country of origin in New York. So this little area on 14th Street, this hospital was built for the French community. Now, they built a second building and it opened on 34th Street. Now, eventually, a lot of these buildings that started out as hospitals or whatever, people end up living them. So the year's now 1889. And there's these rumors that are whispered of what they call an unquiet spirit resides there, even though no one had actually seen anything. However, once per week in the middle of the night, there was the sound of a woman sobbing, the hurried opening and closing of doors, a light footstep running, and the swish of draperies along the hall. A heavier step behind, panting breath, a scuffle, a stifled scream, a sound of heavy blows, a fall, silence only broken by the hurried descent of the staircase and opening and shutting of the front door. Now, the occurrence was a mystery. None knew what happened to whom and what caused this reenactment. But if you listen, you know, the description is, it sounds like a woman or somebody that was killed, you know, and it's like the auditory reenactment of, you know, when they're running away, somebody's following her, kills her, does something, and then leaves. Again, I like these stories. You don't know when they started, who, what, where, and it was just happening. Now, again, we're still in New York. This is at number 71 Washington Square. All right. Now, at this place, there was a sighting of an old man who was dressed in the style of 50 years before. All right. Now, he was solid looking. He stooped slightly and he walked with a cane. And he would be seen that he would just sigh frequently, like in a very heartfelt way, as if he was grieving for someone. No one knew his name. Now, when he would come to the basement of this house at number 171 Washington Square, he would always stop, give a sigh and a groan, and would go down the steps through a closed door. Now, he was noticed the first time opposite number 10 West Washington Place. And he had always would be seen as late as midnight and as early as 10 p.m. So in other words, it's almost one of these hauntings that you hear that, like, you know, sometimes there's a certain anniversary. This one was like on a timetable of like seen as late as midnight or as early as 10. And apparently this was his route where he would go. He's with a cane and he comes to the basement steps and then he disappears. Again, nobody knows who this person was. There's probably anybody that would have been able to recognize him probably had moved away or was dead. Now, this is, okay, this is a pretty but old-fashioned house in Stuyvesant Square, all right? And it has stood empty for several years. Now, in 1883, a man, his wife, and his small daughter moved there. Now, the couple allowed the daughter to play in the empty attic, which apparently had been arranged for children's play, as a children's playroom, long before. In other words, whoever lived there had made it into a child's playroom. Now, there was a fireplace and a large fireboard in front of it. Now, the mother notices that the daughter would slip away repeatedly and go back up to the attic. And when she asked her why she liked it up there so much, she said that she liked to play with a funny little boy with lots of buttons on his jacket. And the girl would go specifically to where the fireboard was in front of the fireplace. Now, the father was an old sea captain, and he starts doing some, I guess, asking around. He finds out that the house had been occupied by an Englishman named Cowdrey, and that he had three children, two boys and a girl. And one of the boys was, in the parlance of the day, an idiot, which meant that he was either slow or retarded. And the story was that this boy had supposedly fallen into the East River as his cap was found there. And whenever the nurse would take him out, he always liked the river. Now, soon after the boy dies in the river, Mr. Cowdrey moves west, sells the house, moves west. Now, the old sea captain, he goes up to the attic and he takes down the fireboard. And in the wall by the side of the chimney, they find the body of the unfortunate boy. The back of the skull was crushed in. Now, he still had the dark blue jacket on with four rows of buttons on the front. And the bones were buried, and the affair kept quiet, but the captain moved his family away from the house. All right. In other words, he was smart enough to understand, if this gets out, that I found the body of this little boy, you know, in the fireplace, plus my daughter. You know, because back then a lot of people said they didn't believe in ghosts, but they would not move into a house that had a reputation for being haunted. And in a minute, I'm going to tell you a story that connects to this one, which has to do with a movie and something that really did happen. Now, this is near Washington Heights. Okay, there's a lady and she's a guest at a house that belonged to a Mr. Beekman. And they're having like a house party. She's there with a bunch of other visitors. And she's given this room, which was once occupied by Mr. Beekman's son, who had died. Now, she's young, and she said, normally I could sleep anywhere, but when I went to this room, I found it impossible to sleep. And she says, I felt this uncontrollable impulse to walk restlessly about the room. But at the same time, I'm feeling this great depression of spirits, which she recognizes is totally unlike her. So she sits down and all of a sudden she feels this pain in her throat, a suffocation, so much so that she faints and falls to the floor. The housekeeper, I guess, hears her hit the floor, finds her, and she's revived. Comes to find out that the owner's son had cut his throat in that very same chair and had fallen and died in the spot where she fell. Okay. It was as an actual haunting? Who knows? Was she maybe a psychic medium and actually tuned in and felt whatever had happened there with that suicide? Now, which is a possibility because this same woman, she's telling how she goes to an old-fashioned hotel that was near what was called Macomb's Dam. And this dam, it spanned the Harlem River between Manhattan and the Bronx. And she's there. She's attending a large party. But they had so many guests that they put some of them up at this small hotel. But this small hotel, apparently some of the rooms hadn't been used in a long time, but they get the overflow guests. So basically they give out the rooms that hadn't been used for some time. Now she ends up sharing the room with this other girl. They're already in bed when all of a sudden the door opens noiselessly and there's a lady with what she thought was a peculiar nightdress on. She has this long hair unbound, comes into the room. She goes to the wardrobe in the corner and there she takes their dresses that they had hung, throws them on the floor, and then goes and counts all the garments that are hung in the wardrobe. Then she walks over to the bureau, looks over every piece of linen, and counts them in a whisper. She can hear this lady whispering and counting. Now, she said that this lady appeared so lifelike that they never suspected she was a ghost, even when she left the room and closed the door behind her. And next morning rolls around. It's raining, so they decide they're going to eat breakfast at the hotel. And this lady that was staying in that room sees a photograph in the parlor of where she's at. And she sees that's a photograph of this lady that came into her room. So she asks the landlady then asks her, she says very strangely, if she had slept well. And she turns around. By the way, at this point, she still doesn't realize it's a ghost. Just because she sees a picture there, it doesn't mean anything. So she tells the landlady the story of what happened the night before. The landlady turns around and tells her, oh, that is my husband's first wife who was very fond of dresses. And before she died, she declared that she could never lie easily in her grave if she thought anyone else was to wear her clothes, and that she would come back every Saturday night and count her clothes. And she has had the landlady, but she never harms anybody. She just counts them and then goes quietly away. You know, like, hey, a girl's got to have fun. All right? Yeah. That was, and sometimes, you know, those are things that mean a lot to you. You know, like, hey, nobody better be wearing my clothes. Mm-hmm. And just in case, I'm going to come and count them. Now, getting back to that other story that I'm going to tell you about the little boy that's killed and left in the fireplace, and that his dad splits, and he says, hey, the kid drowned in the river. We found his cap. Remember, sometimes in a lot of cases, people would drown and their bodies would not be found right away. I'll give you a perfect example. Lake Mead, that was when, with that drought that was there, like during the summer, they started coming up with bodies and people that had drowned or fallen off boats that back in the 50s, the bodies had never been recovered. And now with this drought, they were finding some of them. My point being that you could easily say a child could fall into a river and the body never be found. And oh my God, the child drowned. And just because you didn't produce a body, nobody ever thought, hey, something else had happened. So we're going, this is, by the way, this is my favorite ghost movie Halloween. It's called The Changeling and it stars George C. Scott. It is the best. I consider it one of the best ghost stories. All right. But there's a story, a true story behind The Changeling, or the guy that wrote the story of The Changeling. And this is it. And you're going to see how it has a tie-in to what happens. And if there might be people out there who have seen The Changeling and know the story of what happens with The Changeling. All right? So, here we are. Okay, now, The Changeling, it's 1980, stars George C. Scott, Trish Van Devere, In the movie, people don't realize that it's based on the paranormal events that Russell Hunter experienced while living in an old home near Cheeseman Park in the late 1960s. This is Cheeseman Park in Denver. All right. Now, Hunter, he died in 1996. Originally, he used to work as a musical arranger for CBS TV in New York City, but he moved to Colorado in the mid-1960s to help his parents manage the Three Birches Lodge in Boulder. I take it that sounds like a hotel or something. So he's there. It's the late 1960s. He's starting to look for an apartment in Denver where he could live, and he's trying to work on his music. And he rents a house at 1739 East 13th Avenue, which, by the way, it's been torn down by now. Now, the rent for this house was only $200. And later on, he said that it was $200 because, quote, nobody else wanted to live there. All right. So he says that beginning on February 9th, 1969, he starts to experience these strange phenomena in the house. He said first there was this, quote, unbelievable banging and crashing that he said would start like clockwork at 6 a.m., then would immediately stop when he placed his feet on the floor. Then he would have unseen hands that would turn on faucets, doors would open and close on their own, and paintings would fall to the floor because the walls would start to vibrate. Right? Now, he talks about, he has a meeting with this name, this man. He doesn't say what the name of this man is. This is a social gathering, some party. Who tells him that the house has a third floor that could be reached through a narrow concealed stairs hidden behind the wall of a second floor closet. Now, he gets a friend of his who's an architect, and they find it just like the guy told him. And this is like a secret garret room, and inside he finds a small trunk filled with, quote, a 9-year-old school books and a journal from a century ago. He says that the author of the diary was a disabled boy they kept hidden on the third floor. And he described his favorite toy was a red ball that was also inside the trunk. All right. Now, a few nights after he discovers the trunk, the red rubber ball drops from the top of a spiral staircase in the home. And this, by the way, happened in front of 30 people. If you remember, he has not, this is 1969. The Changeling is not produced till 1980. He wrote that story based on his experiences. But in the movie, you'll remember that red ball. George C. Scott is by himself. But what happens to him is 30 people are there to witness it. So what does he do? He conducts a seance. And the spirit of the child is channeled. And he says that he was the heir to a fortune through his maternal grandfather. However, he was a sickly child, and when he died, his parents concealed his death and buried him in a field in what was then a remote part of Southeast Denver. All right. They adopt a child from the orphanage to take the place of the dead boy, all right, and instruct him to accept his new identity. The healthy boy grows to adulthood and becomes a successful, and as a changeling, claim the inheritance meant for another. In the movie, the father kills a kid. In this one, he's saying the spirit of the child is, he just was sickly and he died. But instead of admitting, because there apparently this inheritance had been left directly for him, they just replace him with a boy from an orphanage. Now, according to Hunter, the troubled spirit of the boy gave him directions to where his body had been concealed under a house on South Dahlia Street. He gained permission to dig, and bones and a gold medal inscribed with a child's name were buried deep in the ground. Coincidentally, the family who owned the house also owned the farmland where the human remains and the gold medallion were found. The discovery did not ease the spirit, and the activity around Hunter escalated. He said, glass doors blew up in my face and severed an artery in my wrist. The inner walls over the head of my bed violently imploded. So, what does he do? He moves to a house on Kearney Street. Now, the disturbances follow him there. Okay, this is about the time he starts realizing that this entity is more malevolent than what he originally thought. So, he follows his friend's advice, and he seeks the help of a priest from Denver's Epiphany Episcopal Church to exorcise the house. Okay, the priest wanted to remain anonymous said about Hunter, you know, he's apparently they went and interviewed him. Quote, he did seem to have a problem. We performed the rites of exorcism in his second house on Kearney Street. Whether the rites were successful or not is not known. However, he did not call the priest again. Now, soon after he moves away, this mansion, which was called the Treat Rogers Mansion, was demolished. And Hunter said he came to see its destruction, and he said, quote, as the walls of the wing, which had contained my bedroom, collapsed, they suddenly flew outward and crushed to death the man operating the bulldozer. I haven't looked that up. I have to look that up to see if it's true or not. Now, what's the backstory? Because remember, he's moved into this house in 1969. What is the backstory to that house? Now, at the turn of the century, there's a childless couple that lived there in that home at 1739 East 13th Avenue. This is central Denver. All right, the couple is Henry Treat Rogers. He's a prominent lawyer. And his wife, Kate Rogers. Now, they filed a permit with the city of Denver back in July of 1892 to build a brick dwelling in the Wyman's Addition of Denver. They have an architect named Henry Ten Ick Wendell, and he designs the house for them. But the land had its own peculiar history. Back in 1858, all right, there's a guy named Mr. Biancroft. Mr. Biancroft comes to mine, and he brings with him his three sons and a son-in-law named John Stoffel. They build a cabin at Vasquez Fort. Now remember, even though eventually this will become the city of Denver, back then I guess it was the middle of nowhere. People are mining. How's that? Now, they're a German family. They're very enterprising. And not only are they panning for gold, but they own livestock. So one day, Mr. Biancroft and two of his sons go off to look for lost cattle. When they returned, the third brother was gone, and the only person who stayed behind was John Stoffel. And he's got this queer behavior that instantly makes them suspicious. Now, soon neighbors come to help look for the missing man, for the missing brother, and finally they find him behind a log out in the woods, and he's been shot through the head. Now, John Stoffel's arrested, and he's brought to what was then called Auraria, which was West Denver. Now, on April the 8th, he appears before a temporary magistrate and admits that he murdered Thomas Biancroft. But his reasons were far from ordinary. He describes where he followed his brother-in-law from Germany to the United States for the purpose of murdering him. What he was avenging was never known. So in other words, this guy, John Stoffel, has, from Germany, I guess they're all German, has something that he hates about Thomas Biancroft. Okay? Marries his sister, comes with a family, but all this time, he's waiting for an opportunity to murder him, and he does, but it's never known. So in those days, there was no cell to hold him, nor any place to try him. So the people gather for an informal deliberation. And since there was no doubt of his guilt, because he admitted to it, they decided to hang him. All that was needed was a rope, a wagon, and a yoke of oxen. So he was executed a large cottonwood tree. Now there's this, what they call an eccentric, well-known character, who was known as Noisy Tom. So they get Noisy Tom to play the part of the executioner. In other words, Noisy Tom did the dirty work. They hanged the guy, and soon after that, they cut down the tree. Now, John Stoffel becomes the first burial at what it becomes known as Prospect Hill Cemetery, that was staked up by General William Larimer at the corner of Cheeseman and Congress. Now, the informal names of the graveyard was Boneyard and Boot Hill. Remember, this is the place where eventually this house is going to be built. Now, there's an undertaker named Mr. Wally who took the cemetery over. And by 1866, there's already 626 people buried there. Now, in 1872, the cemetery becomes a property of the United States. This is due to a treaty with the Arapaho. The city of Denver buys it for $1.25 an acre. And then it's renamed the Denver City Cemetery, right? So, here's 1890. The cemetery's fallen into disuse. And it's decided to convert it into a park, right? Families were instructed to move the graves of their loved ones. And they were offered a free plot as an incentive. But After 3 years, only 700 were moved. What does that mean? There's plenty left there. So there's a Mr. E.P. McGovern. He's a local undertaker, and he's hired by the government to take care of the unclaimed ones. For every box he delivers to Riverside Cemetery, he receives $1.90. Now, he was found trying to cheat the city, and his workers, to boot, were robbing the graves for any personal effects found inside the coffins. Remember, these are the times that people would get buried with their jewelry, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He's fired, even though the work was unfinished, and they didn't hire anybody else to complete the work. So there you go. So the cemetery gets converted to Cheeseman Park and opens in 1907, and soon whispered rumors circulate the grounds were haunted. Now, some estimate that as many as 4,000 bodies were left behind, but the true number has not been ascertained. However, every time irrigation work is started, bones are found. Besides the forgotten dead, located just south of the cemetery was what they call a pest house or pestilence hospital for contagious patients that received thousands of souls that were left there to die. Some think that fear of contagion, especially smallpox, was another reason why so many bodies were left behind. In other words, even then, they thought that if the bodies there, some of them had died from smallpox, that they were still contagious. In 2010, while they were completing irrigation work at Cheeseman Park, the city employees unearthed 4 skeletons. The coroner found that they were over a century old, and if there was ever a tombstone to commemorate them, it's long gone. Perhaps they were criminals or paupers, and they were anonymous from the beginning. They were reinterred in Mount Olivet Cemetery. And you better believe there's other people that are dead. They just haven't been found because nobody's needed to dig in that area. Let's go back to the Rogers family. Okay. The location of the Rogers' new home was probably built over these forgotten graves. But you know what they say? Ignorance is bliss. And the house was built like they specified. Now, they didn't have any children, but they did have a niece and nephew who spent time living in the home with them. The niece, her name was Frances Clark Christine, and she came from Illinois to live with them when she was 10 years old, and she stayed there until she married a man named George Christine. Now, after she lives for several years in Chicago, and with her husband, they returned to Denver after her uncle, which is Henry Treat Roger. He dies in 1922, so they come to accompany the aunt, and they live in the house there with the aunt, Kate Rogers, who, by the way, had formally adopted Frances as her daughter around 1927. Okay, and this leads me to believe, because remember, by this time in 1927, Frances is an adult married woman, so I have a feeling it probably had to do with inheritance or something along those lines. So while she's living with her aunt, Frances becomes the longtime secretary for the Denver Orphans Home and the president of the Globeville Day Nursery. And eventually, her aunt dies in 1931, and she inherits the house at 1739 East 13th Avenue and also a small fortune. But it's really funny because even though she's a young woman, she dies 3 years later. She follows her aunt to the grave 3 years later. Who ends up with the money? Her husband, George. George Christine inherits the money, and he doesn't die till 1966. So, and there's another side. Frances had a brother who they changed his name, called Henry Treat Rogers, the second. Okay? Because remember, they both came to live with that couple when they were children. This family is connected. They send Henry Treat Rogers a second. They send him to Yale, graduates in 1914, and he comes to work for his uncle's law firm, which was Rogers, Ellis, and Johnson around 1916. All right. This younger Henry Treat Rogers that lived in the house, World War I breaks out, and he enlists in 1917 to fight. And he never returns home because he dies in 1918 at the age of 25. Okay. Now, Russell Hunter, his real last name was Ellis. Some people say that he never lived in the mansion. They've tried to do research that show his parents did own the Three Birches Lodge in Boulder. and that he may have been in Denver in the late 1960s, but apparently he was a renter. Back then, they didn't keep those records. Now, at some point that later on, they that place was also the Bombay Club. And in other words, between the time that the families lived there, that was like a house, it was also businesses. Like I said, it was the Bombay Club. Now, in 2015, there's a blogger, and his name is Larry, and he posts the following. He says, "My family, parents with seven kids, moved into this house in 1959 when I was 8 years old. It was a huge house with two separate staircases leading to the second floor, one with a halfway landing and the other was an enclosed spiral coming off the kitchen for servants. I never experienced any paranormal activities. Perhaps the ghost enjoyed the company of all the children." Okay. Now, in a strange coincidence, Peter Medak, he is the director of the movie The Changeling. He becomes fascinated with the story because he had his own recent deaths in his family. His older brother had died, and in 1971, his wife, Catherine LeCamarance Medak, she's 28, she commits suicide by jumping from a fourth floor apartment in Harley Street in London. All right. She falls into the basement area. She's pronounced dead upon her arrival at Middlesex Hospital. Her husband wasn't there. He was away visiting his mother. But because of all these recent deaths that he's had, he sees the script or the story that Hunters produced based on what he happened to him in 1969. And he goes on to direct the film, The Changeling. In 2021, there's another blogger. His name is Frost. And he writes, "When I was 9 or 10, I used to bag Mr. Hunter's leaves." He's basically saying that this guy Hunter did live there. "He lived down the street from my family with his black dog named Loki. His house was filled with antiques and a large piano, which he played well. I witnessed a few interesting situations at his home. The story he told me was of a little boy who was killed by a coal cart in front of the mansion. The boy's name was Eric. That was the spirit that haunted the mansion and supposedly followed Mr. Hunter to his new residence near me. Great individual. I moved in 88, never saw him again. I believe he passed in 94. Okay. Which what that tells you is, if anybody sees The Changeling, he does integrate the story about the child being killed by the coal cart into the Changeling story, which basically leads them, you know, the storyline is, it leads them on a goose chase because they're thinking originally that this is the spirit that's haunting. Later on, they find out that it's really the ghost of the Changeling boy. All right. So there you go. Happy Halloween, everybody. All right. We're going to be doing a Mardi Gras. Do you have any more stories, Henry? Are you done?
I believe I'm done.
You're done? Okay. Well, we're going to go do a big bonfire outside, guys. And we will be seeing you. Well, I'll be seeing you next week. I've got a lot of great guests. All right. Waiting in the wings. You're really going to like the guests that I have. Talking about a lot of different weird, unusual things. Please don't forget to sign up for my Substack newsletter, mppellicer.com, miamighostchronicles.com. Again, not only do I have links for all the videos on the websites, also podcast versions of Stories of the Supernatural, Nightshade Diary, Supernatural Storytime, yada, yada, yada. You can find them all there. Okay, so please, thank you again for being part of my audience. You are all wonderful. And again, happy Halloweeny. Take care. Say bye, Henry.
Bye-bye.